This is accession number 10657, reel 6.
Lewis, Reel 6. When you were preparing for patrol and selecting the men that were going to go with you, how did you go about doing that? Were there individual men who were recognisably better at patrol technique than others?
Yes. There were also individual officers and NCOs who were better. And this was one of the unfair things, I suppose, about an infantry battalion, because it meant that the guys who were good at it were always getting selected to go out again. And I had a corporal, his name was Corporal Pearson actually, who was a marvellous bloke in all ways. And yet as soon as we get on leave anywhere in Alexandria or Cairo, he gets in terrible scrapes and his stripes are taken away immediately. Because as soon as he comes back to the battalion, we give him his stripes back. But Pearson was absolutely first rate. And the really good ones didn't mind going out night after night. Now, whilst they were prepared to volunteer or make it be known that they didn't mind going out, other guys who were either lazy or didn't particularly want to do it didn't bother to put their names forward. So consequently, most of the patrolling, in the 8th Battalion anyway, was done by a small number of officers and a small number of men in the various companies involved. You tended to choose the blokes you knew wouldn't let you down. You didn't want somebody who was going to be coughing all over the place, or somebody who was a little bit dim, because some of them were a little bit dim compared to others. So you picked your best men. In fact, our finest patrol man, really, a man named Hurst, who came up from the ranks and was commissioned from the guards, went out night after night at Alamein and finally made a mistake and was killed. But he didn't have to go out as much as he did. But he did.
Now, you say they didn't mind going out. Did any of them actually enjoy it?
I don't think you could say that you enjoy it, because it's, you know, going out under those conditions, you never quite know what you're going to meet up with. You might have met up with a bigger enemy patrol that would shoot you up and you'd be finished. You might have met up, even though it was night, there might have been an armoured car suddenly appear out of nowhere or something. So, although a lot of the patrols were quite uneventful, there was always the feeling that something might go wrong. Maybe we won't find our way back to the truck. Maybe the truck will be surprised by an enemy patrol and there won't be a truck to find our way back to. Maybe it'll get light before we're halfway back to the box and we're out in the open in daylight. All those sort of things. So it wasn't a thing that I don't think anybody looked forward to it, really. Certainly you didn't do that, I don't think.
What were the qualities of a man who's likely to be good on patrol? What sort of characteristics would he have?
Well,
you needed,
look for? You'd want somebody who was pretty bright and pretty quick to react quickly in a situation. Somebody who you knew you could rely on to do what he was told to do quickly and without any argument or anything, and who had good reactions. That was basically it. And of course, who was good with weapons, whatever it may be, whether it was a Bren gun or a Thompson submachine gun or a rifle. But you very soon were able to spot. I mean, I'm not going to say that there were any blokes in my platoon or my company who were a dead loss. There weren't. But there was a hard core of them who were really very good at everything they did.
Was there any compensation for them? You say they would go out night after night and other chaps wouldn't.
No.
Did they get any sort of relief from other routine duties?
No. No, because, I mean, what would happen? I mean, there wasn't a great deal of choice. I mean, for instance, Jake Jackson, when he was CO, when he'd taken over at Kazala, would come roaring through the company area, and I did quite a lot of patrolling, and so did a chap named Philip Hampson. And he would sort of say, "Where's Hampson?" No answer. "Well, then Lewis will do." And I get wheeled in, simply because probably we'd been out two nights previously. In the same way, the Sergeant Major would go around, "Corporal Jones, Pearson then," and the names would roll off, you know, it would be the same ones every time.
Did you notice that they came from any particular part of the county, or
no,
they had anything in common?
No, I can't really remember that. I think most of them came from places like Stanley, Houghtonley Spring, all pretty close to Durham itself. That's to say the Durham chaps, whereas the Coileys came from wherever the Coileys come from. The Cosbys.
Did you find that the men who were good at patrolling the desert were also good at patrolling in Sicily?
I can't answer that one, because I didn't actually do any... Well, we did do a bit of patrolling in Sicily, yes, when we first landed. But I don't know the answer to that one, but I would say that there would not be very much difference. If they're good at patrolling in one manner of patrolling, they would be good in another. It's a sort of frame of mind as well you've got to get into. As I say, you don't enjoy it, but you probably like to do it well, you know.
You described your first night patrol when you went out and looked at the minefield.
Yes.
And came back. Can you remember what your first daylight patrol was like?
Well, that first daylight patrol, I do remember going out with the carriers. This was in fact the patrol where the corporal shot the holes in the sump of the ambulance. But I do remember going as far as some cover, which would be just down behind a mound, a little hump in the desert, you know, where we were undercover from many tracks. And I remember cracking a couple of eggs over the mudguard of the carrier, and they fried immediately. Instant fried egg in about 2 seconds. We got the gunner OP with us and that sort of thing. And we knew that these commerce raids had been going on and they'd been very successful, so we didn't feel particularly queasy about it. When we first broke cover and you're roaring towards these things and opening fire, nobody's firing back at you, and it's not difficult to be fairly confident in those circumstances.
Were you actually in command of that patrol?
I was in command of the patrol, yes. The platoon commander would always be in command of the patrol, and the section of the carrier platoon would be allocated under command of that platoon commander.
So what did you have with you then as a force? You had the gunner OP.
We had the gunner OP. We had three Bren carriers, if I remember rightly, which would be a section from the carrier platoon, and there would have been a section of infantry as well. And I think probably we left the Vickers on a flank somewhere, something like that.
Did you take any anti-tank guns with you?
No. No, we didn't. They were 2-pounder anti-tank. They would have been all right, even though they were only 2-pounders in those days. But they're fairly heavy things to lug along. You've got to, we could have done, I suppose, but I don't recollect that we did.
They were on portee, weren't they?
Yes, but they could also be towed. But they were, and the portees were soft-skinned, very high vehicles, in fact. They were most ungainly things.
How did you actually get to your ambush position? Did you just motor straight to it from Strickland's, or did
you go on a compass bearing. Yeah, when we get out to Strickland's post, we know that if we go on a compass bearing for 9 miles, whatever it was, you will be in the vicinity of many tracks, near to whatever. I mean, there were one or two places in the desert that were easily recognisable. There was a place called Heinkel Post, where a Heinkel had crashed. And it stood there with its wing stuck up in the air. So that was a landmark. There was another place called Tank Valley, where there'd been a tank battle with the Valentines. And there was an abandoned tank an Italian tank, where they buried the crew inside the tank. We knew that because all the sand was piled on top right up into the turret. They couldn't get them out. They used to bury them underneath in the thing. Things like that. There were landmarks, and there were little piles of stones every now and then. We used to call them trigs, I think. Trig something or other, or point number so-and-so. So there were one or two visible landmarks that you could pick up if you were going on a particular course in a particular direction. But once you got within many tracks, which was a long area of tracked road churned up with things, you'd got a pretty big choice, left or right or whatever. So you wouldn't necessarily come out bang on the same place that you came out on the previous day.
So if what you told me runs like this, doesn't it, you'd get into a hull down position where you couldn't be seen.
Right.
Get your OP where he could look over the tracks.
Right.
When the enemy appeared, when they were in a suitable position, he'd stop them with gunfire from 25 pounds.
Ideally, if you could do that, yes.
If you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you would then
break cover
and just
charge them. Down and destroy as many of their soft-skinned vehicles as we could.
Did you ever go out specifically to get prisoners from that sort of thing?
Oh, yes, that was the point. If you could bring back prisoners, that was always very valuable. Because, one, they might, for instance, be infantry reinforcements or something being taken in a 3-ton lorry somewhere, and you would then have advance information of another unit that had come into the area. Oh, yes, you were supposed to do that. So it would not quite right to say that we sort of shot them up and then charged around and came back. We would also try and get some prisoners from whatever trucks we had immobilised. That's why we were in the area of the trucks when the corporal put the bullets through the sump.
You mentioned trying to reassure the Italians you didn't really mean it.
Yes.
It was an accident. Did any of them speak English?
No.
Or you speak Italian?
No, not all that much. I mean, it was a quite farcical situation, really, because they were shouting at us. I mean, it's easier to understand what the Italian is saying, being rude, than it is for an Italian to understand an Englishman trying to say sorry, because I forget the sort of words they were, like brutto, which everybody knows means brutal, you know. Well, we don't have anything. Well, we do have brutal, but we're trying to say sorry. I mean, we didn't know enough Italian to be able to say sorry properly, so they were just getting more and more angry, you know, and I thought it was really quite a ridiculous situation.
At this point, the armoured cars turned up.
Well, as they appeared on the horizon down the column, and we were no match for them with our Brens, so we had to hightail it out of there quickly.
Did you ever come across Italian convoys that resisted strongly against this sort of raid?
No, except the night one, and I wasn't on that patrol, when Captain Pitt shot up that car. They mined, first of all, they mined many tracks, but an armoured car was right up forward in that column and ran onto one of the mines and set it off, and they knew straight away that there was somebody in the vicinity. So that B Company patrol got involved in a very fierce firefight with the column at night. But I can't recollect anything happening during the day to any daylight patrol.
Did you have mortars along with you on your...
We'd have had 2-inch, I would have thought. We would take a 2-inch, because that's a fairly easy weapon to cart around with you. But no, not necessarily a 3-inch, but we certainly would have had a 2 with us.
What did you use that for on these occasions?
Well, you could use it if you've got the range right, you can plop a few mortar bombs down as well. But really, the guns did what was necessary. And I mean, they were able to range better than we were, with the OP actually there. whereas you can get a mortar range pretty quickly, but it was quicker and easier to get the guns on. And they also had a heavier calibre shell.
What were the Vickers guns supposed to do? Were they just to protect your flank from interference?
Well, two things, really. To protect the flank, you could say, yes. And also to open fire on the column. Probably if they... I mean, the left-hand ones would probably have sent a few bursts of fire across at the first lorry, which could bring that to a halt in the same way that the gunfire did. The whole object of the exercise really was to stop a half a dozen or a dozen vehicles so that they were an easy target.
Did all your daylight patrols follow a similar sort of pattern?
Yes. It was Jake Jackson's idea he was most keen on taking offensive action from the Ghazala line, because quite apart from anything else, taking up a point you raised earlier on, he didn't want the chaps to get bored. He wanted them to have something to do, and that was his idea.
What did you make of the Italians when you actually caught them?
Oh, delighted to be taken prisoner, actually. I mean, there was one occasion, I forget where it was, but one occasion where two or three Italians were taken prisoner, and they said to us, if you like to go back, or if you like to hang around for a few minutes, you can have a general as well. Something like that, you know. But they weren't. I mean, there were one or two divisions, like the Folgori, which was a paratroop division at Alamein, which were good. But the average Italian soldier was never meant to be a fighting man at all. They were pathetic, really. The Germans, of course, had no time for them whatsoever. And it was not unusual when a large body of Italian prisoners was being marched back towards the box at Ghazala for the Germans to open fire on the tail end of the column, on the Italians. In fact, I actually saw that happen on one occasion. They didn't get on with them at all well. And they also pinched all their transport at Alamein and left the Italians to walk after the final breakthrough. When the Germans started withdrawing, they simply pinched all the Italian lorries. The Italians who had to walk and who were marshalled and rounded up in their tens of thousands. They were really like children, but also like some children, they could be very cruel. It was Italians who booby-trapped some of the bodies of some of our chaps at Marith, in the Wadi Zigzag. I don't know of that, of the Germans doing that, and I know other instances of the Italians being very cruel as well, when they had the upper hand. But when they didn't, they were just like children. And not at all impressive.
What did you think of the Italian equipment?
It wasn't as good as the German. I don't think it was as good as the German. The German equipment was the best all round, I think. We did capture a whole lot of stuff the day I went out, but, you know, anti-tank guns and all that sort of thing, but I wouldn't think it was not as good. I mean, the German, you know, Rommel's Africa Corps was specifically kitted out for the North African campaign, and everything they had got was absolutely right for desert warfare, down to their petrol cans, which were called jerry cans.
When you were capturing these Italians, did you ever capture any local levies, Libyan troops?
No, nothing like that at all. No.
Just
never
Europeans.
Saw any. Never saw any at all. I wouldn't think they would have been involved in that Ghazala thing, actually. I think they were probably L of C if they did anything at all, driving lorries, bringing up supplies, that sort of thing.
How many day patrols do you think you did then before you had to break out of Ghazala?
How many patrols? I don't know, how long were you
doing
there?
You know, one or two a week or more?
Yes, about that, I suppose. Well, there'd be a commerce. Patrols would go out every morning and every evening. That was part of Jake's strategy. So I suppose we all did about three or four.
Per week,
something like that. Well, no, not per week. I would say maybe two or three per week. Maybe one would be a commerce raid and the other two would be a night patrols or something like that.
So I think I'm right in saying it's about 22 days or so after you'd arrived that the Germans started moving up. On the 27th of May, the Brescia and Pavia divisions moved forward to contain the box and watch it while the Germans were swinging round to the south.
That's right. I mean, they then they put in everything they'd got against the 9th. Oh, no, that was at Mersmatru, wasn't it? No, we did lose a brigade at Ghazala, of course we did. 150 Brigade.
They were the immediate south of the 151 Brigade.
That's right, which was completely written off by the Germans.
I think they just drove through that one, didn't they?
Something like that, but it left us in a very tricky position, so we didn't have any option other than to break out from Ghazala.
How did you become aware of the German attack? Did you see anything of it, or hear it going past.
You could hear quite a lot going on over in the 69th Brigade area, but you know, although you can hear a lot, you never quite know how big it is, whether it's a local action or what. And I don't think we knew. We were fully aware of what was happening until we knew that, you know, the whole brigade, 150 Brigade, had just disappeared.
How did you hear that? Were you just told?
Well, that would have come through. You know, there would have been messages intercepted, I dare say, and eventually passed down to the battalions.
Were there any extra precautions or activities taken after the Germans had pushed up?
I don't think there was. Oh, there would have been. I think we would have been very much more careful about. I mean, having lost a complete brigade, we might have been the next one to get clobbered. So that, I mean, there would be extra care taken out at the outpost and also in the FTLs in the Gazala box as well. But we didn't have an awful lot of time to do that because the decision was very soon made that we had got to break out and get right down to the south and swing round Bir Hakeim and then go to Fort Maddalena, because we would have been surrounded and just chopped up piecemeal, and we would have suffered the same fate as 150 Brigade.
So you were doing exactly the same kind of thing after the Germans had started moving us, until you broke out.
Yes, I don't think there probably wasn't much more about a few days in it, you know. I don't think there was very, it wasn't a week or anything like that, I don't think. I mean, the book would tell us, but I don't think it was very long.
Did you ever have to go and man the outpost?
No, I never actually went out to the outpost. I went out there quite a lot, but I didn't have the job of having a platoon out there at the outpost. Not that I can remember. But, I mean, I wasn't there all that time, really, you see. It was only from the 5th of... Only there for 4 weeks, which isn't a long time.
What happened to you during the breakout, then?
Well, the breakout was the first of what actually earned us the name the Gazala Gazelles from the Germans eventually, because they reckoned that when we started going anywhere in a hurry to get away from them, we moved pretty fast, which nobody disputed. But there was only one way to get out of Gazala, and that was to get on our lorries and our Bren carriers and drive out. And that's exactly what happened. We went out to the outposts, the two outposts, that's Strickland's and Stanley, I think, and there were two or three columns, I forget which, but these columns were made up of 1,500 weight trucks, Bren carriers, 3-ton lorries, ambulances, guns towing 25-pounders, and they were formed up into a column, and we simply drove right the way through the German positions and out the other side. Quite remarkable. It had never been done before, you know, but it's the sort of thing that you can do in the desert, especially if you have the element of surprise, which we did have, and we were able to break out, going right the way through their forward positions, going right through their lines of communication and all their admin areas and their B echelons, and finally right down to Bir Hakeim, where the Free French was still holding, and we swung round and then went straight along to Maddalena. And that was the one big, that was the first of three breakouts, the Gazala one.
How long did it take?
9 o'clock at night, I think we started.
When you've been warned that you'd have to do this?
We were warned, I think, either the previous day or in the morning, that we would be evacuating the Gazala box that night. So, of course, there's frenzied activity then to get everything ready and packed up. You know, take the field dressing, the REMC field dressing station or whatever, casualty clearing. They got a hell of a lot of stuff to pack up in the ambulances and that. There was ammunition. There's everything back at B echelon. There's the QMs. They've got to load all their trucks up. The troop carriers have got to be organised. Because everybody had to go on wheels. There was no other way of doing it. And we would have had a troop carrying company allotted to us to do that.
Which post did you form up at then? You were C Company, weren't you?
No, B.
You were B Company.
Yes, I was B Company by then, and Ian Pitt was the company commander. I think we formed up at Strickland's.
Hadn't you moved then? Because I understood you were in C Company initially.
No, C Company when I started.
Yes.
C Company when I first went there, because the company commander I remember was Burden Taylor. But at some stage or other, I was transferred to B, and I don't know why, but there would have been some reason or other. And I then came under Captain Pitt.
How did he compare to Burden Taylor?
Burden Taylor was a bit useless, actually. But Pitt was a good chap, very good soldier, good company commander too. Oh, Burden Taylor's still going strong these days, so I mustn't say too much about him. But it was a difference between a typical as a company commander. Burden Taylor was very, very county, Durham County, you know, and very much in peacetime, I would have thought, out with the hounds and all that sort of thing, and his father sitting on the bench and what have you. Whereas Ian Pitt, although he was a Durham bloke, went to Durham School and was a very much more down-to-earth, tough sort of, you know, rugby playing and all that sort of thing. So the two company commanders, I was much happier serving under Ian Pitt. I don't think I could have been with Burden Taylor long, actually.
Did you take your platoon with you, or did you get a fresh one?
Oh, no, I would have got a fresh one. You didn't, yes, you've got to get to know a whole lot of new blokes if you go to another company. I can't remember why. It might be that they might have had somebody gone sick or something in B Company who was short of platoon commanders.
Do you remember the new platoon being different in any significant way to the one you'd left in C Company?
I don't think so, no, I don't think so. The level of training was about the same with everybody, I think, you know. Well, they're quite used to officers being moved around. If somebody gets... I mean, one bloke was killed, Robbie Robinson, so he would have had to be replaced, and others go off sick and that sort of thing. So officers are moving around, much more than NCOs, actually.
You mentioned sickness, and earlier on you were discussing the disposal of rubbish by burning and so on. Was there a lot of sickness in the...
No. We had a very, very good record. And that was entirely due to the fact that we had a damn good medical officer, absolutely first-rate Scotsman, Andrew Noble, and we had a first-rate group of sanitary corporals. Each company had its own one, trained by the MO. And if you had a good MO and well-trained sanitary corporals, you didn't get sickness in a battalion. We had a very low level of sickness, actually. Surprisingly, well, not surprisingly, but... the Maoris, whom we took over from at Alamein, had left the whole of their battalion area in an appalling state, and it took us days to bury all the muck and stuff they'd left lying around. I mean, they were leaving themselves wide open, but perhaps they were more resilient than we were. But we didn't have a big incidence of sickness at all.
What sort of complaints did people get when they did go sick?
Jippy tummy, what we used to call jippy tummy, malaria. Desert sores, of course, were very nasty. Fortunately, I never had desert sores, but they were devilish things to get rid of. Sort of running sores, if I remember. I don't know what that came from. Probably a lack of salt, which was why we used to have quite a lot of salt in our diet. Well, I say our diet, I think it was included as much as possible, you know, because I think that helped. I believe so, anyway. But
to get back to the breakout,